Hello and welcome to Game Brain, a board game podcast about our gaming group. I'm Ben Mandelker, and joining me today is Jordan. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
I'm great, thanks. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Excited to talk about some games.
I know. It's going to be... We have some fun ones to discuss today. I mean, I think the plan is we're just going to chat about some games today. No deep dives, just like some recent plays, and we're going to see where the discussion takes us, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think we're... Wait, did we decide there was something we were going to say, talk about? I think we're just going to follow.
We're going to
follow our hearts.
That's right. That's right.
You know, Sometimes we have a deep dive. Some days we just want to share what we've been playing, and that can help maybe inform people's decisions on what games they want to buy or get to the table, you know?
Yeah. We floated the idea, I think, or maybe I just thought it in my head, of focusing on space games, because there's three of them that we want to discuss. Oh. But there's also three games that are not space games that we want
to discuss. This is true. Actually, so. I think that was in your head, but like I'm okay. Totally down to do some musing on space games a little bit later. So you heard it here first. We're going to talk about space games later and non-space games.
And non-space games. Exactly.
First, by the way, you know, you may have seen our shameless promotion and shilling for ourselves, which is at the Golden Geek nomination. It's like nomination time where they're creating their ballot, and it's open for Board Game Geek users to go and vote for who they want to be best podcast or best Euro game or heavy game and all these different categories. It's really fun just to do those kind of things. If you're feeling kind, send us a vote. No obligation, obviously, and obviously there's no way for us to know if you've done it or not. Feel free to lie to us. We're happy with just
or
pretending.
Just don't tell us at all. You
don't
know,
tell
I'm,
us.
I'm not sure if it's in the nomination phase or the
it's
voting.
It's not nomination.
Phase.
It's voting.
Oh, it's already
it's,
voting.
No. It's I'm sorry. It's in the phase of just getting us to be nominated.
Right.
So we, you know, so this is going to be also our phase one of begging, like get us in the ballot, please, and then. Then comes phase two where we say, vote for us, please.
But we should at least be on the ballot, I think.
I hope so. But, you know, there's also a lot of really wonderful other podcasts
there sure
out there. And, you know what? Like, this is one of those things where, you know, I often don't say this, but I really am happy for, like, people I'm competing against.
sure.
In this situation.
Yeah, it's interesting going on the list of podcasts you can nominate because there are so many. And many,
so many
I've never heard of. Many of them might be new. Some of them actually might be old and they're still on the list and they haven't released new episodes in a long time. But you can always go and, you know, click through and see if there's one that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
It's a great way to actually discover new
board
game podcasts.
I was about to
podcasts.
Say that. It's
so I would recommend doing that.
And some of them have been doing it forever. Blue Peg Pink Peg is like one of my all-time favorite board game podcasts. And they've been doing it for almost as long as Watch What Crappens, which
wow
is a long time. I think like 10 years or so. And they're great. So vote for them too. Put them on the ballot as well. And
well, actually, I don't know. Have they won in the past?
They haven't won.
Oh, okay, because you can only win once, right?
You can only win once, yeah. Then you're out of. And they're really like Rob Rouse, who is like one of the hosts. He always gets very excited to win, and then then they don't, and then he gets very crestfallen on the podcast.
Oh,
so
poor guy.
So I'm just saying, but for us though, yeah, if you're feeling kind, if you're feeling moved to do so, then for sure, you know, throw us in the ring. Now, maybe some people might not want to,
mm-hmm,
based off of some Reddit feedback recently.
Oh yes, we had I saw a Reddit post about your finger etiquette pod, Ben.
Yes, which by the way, I want to say that the art on that podcast accidentally and coincidentally looks like Jordan's
okay
face.
Okay, you know what? It doesn't look that much like my face, but I thought it was me. I was worried.
When I chose the art, I was like, let me find, I don't know, a picture of someone chewing their nails. I was like, oh, here's someone with a, I just took a picture. I just chose a picture that someone with a beard. And then, as it turns out, then you were like, you texted me and was like, are you doing me dirty or something?
Yeah, I thought it was like a zoomed in
photo. I was like putting you on
me
blast, like, yeah, for chewing your fingernails. I wasn't.
Which I don't think I do.
No, I think what you do is sometimes you hold your fingers close.
I put my hand over my mouth on
and I'm
sometimes.
I'm of the mindset that, like, I think that, like, fingers can touch lips.
Mm.
You know, like, yeah, you can't be totally rigid.
Yeah.
But like it's just more like the deep, it's the insertion and the deep insertion in the
sure
saliva
sure
that,
that
where
I
where I have more of an issue.
Yeah.
But apparently some people had issues with my issues.
Well, no, I saw an interesting Reddit post and I brought it up to you this morning of, you know, someone went on Reddit. I think the post has actually been deleted now, but you know, they went on and said, oh, you know, what? How do you feel about these rules? Is it too strict to have so many rules or to have this deep of a discussion? Can't people just be considerate? And then there were some people in the comments who were saying, you know, an even more extreme version of this is crazy to have so many rules. And there were some people in the pod, you know, in the comments saying, oh, no, it's great. You know, you should have the rules that you have and people need to, you know, be careful around games. And so it was an interesting discussion to read through. I think you can still read through the comments, but I think the original post is gone.
I mean, that's why I love etiquette posts, because I do love the back and forth, because it's such a great area when it comes to etiquette. It is also ironic to me that here we are in a hobby that is dependent on rules. Like, it's all about the rules, following the rules, understanding the rules, playing by the rules. And so the idea that I might say, hey, here's some concepts that could be viewed as rules.
Sure.
People are like, what? Rules?
Are you gonna, yeah. Some of the
That's
posts,
outrageous.
Some of the posts were saying, are you going to send out this, you know, 50-page document to all of your game night attendees? Like, obviously not, you know?
No,
we're
no,
just
no.
talking about it.
I do want to clarify. This is not me saying, like these are the rules. And this is the It's just more like, you should consider these things the way you consider etiquette in any part of your life.
100%.
You know, and technically there are rules of etiquette. It doesn't mean that you are going to get a failing grade or anything like that.
Or that you as the host need to enforce these rules by kicking people out of your game group or being rigid in any sort of way.
But I think it's one of those things where, like, you aspire, I feel like with etiquette, I aspire to follow etiquette as best I can, because, you know, etiquette is to make people feel more comfortable. And, you know, like, I think it's also like a courtesy. And I'm not even good at following my own rules. You know, I should say quote unquote rules, but, like, you know, I laid out all these things about, you know, what you should and shouldn't do in my mind, but I've flagrantly violated them. So I'm aspiring to follow them too.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting area, in particular, because you don't know if you're violating rules of etiquette, generally speaking, and you could go into a new situation and you could behave in a way that you think is totally fine because you're not aware. And people around you are like, what is that guy doing? Like, that's not okay. Or that's a little strange, or, you know, that makes me uncomfortable, whatever it may be. And if no one's going to tell you that those are violations of some sort of code you've entered into, then you're never going to know and you're going to keep going. And
exactly.
So this is just it was a cool episode to think about, to, you know, put yourself in the mode of, I'm sitting there at game night. How should I act? What should I eat? What should I not eat? Et cetera, et cetera. And oftentimes you don't have time in the moment to think of it either.
You don't.
You're so focused on the game. So this is just like, hey, you know, consider this.
Consider this, because you may not realize you may be, like, upsetting people, like a behavior that you think is just commonplace. It may be making someone, like, uncomfortable, and they may not have the tools to confront you. Because I think what's also interesting about etiquette is, a lot of times the person who is committing the infraction, it's like almost more, it's feels more offensive to call them out about it than it is for them to do it in the first place. So if someone shows up wearing no deodorant and they stink, and to people who don't wear deodorant, like this one, this is a pretty hard line for me. Like, if you were for people who choose not to wear deodorant, like that's going to be a problem for me.
Sure.
You know, but you know, how many times have people shown up to a game night without wearing deodorant? It happens once in a while.
Right.
And they stink. They stink to holy hell. And maybe they don't think they do or whatever, but they stink. Mm-hmm. But does anyone ever say, hey, buddy, like, I just want to let you know, like, you kind of smell tonight. No one would ever do that.
Right.
Because it's, like, more offensive somehow to actually correct someone's behavior. It's almost like you are violating their autonomy, their decision. They made a decision not to wear deodorant, and you're, like, violating their choices in life. And that's, like, ruder than the fact that they are creating a smelly environment for everyone else. It's just interesting how etiquette works in that way.
Yeah, it's something that most of the time you need to be aware of yourself, because nobody's going to correct you. They're just going to judge you silently.
Yes.
Right. So really the episode's more for attendees than it is for hosts prescribing certain rules, you know?
Yeah, it's really not
supposed
to
be
super rigid.
Right.
And if anything, it's actually also to kind of help out. Like, no one wants to, the reason why we don't say, like, hey, buddy, you smell, or hey, lady, you smell,
right,
is because you know, it could create a sense of embarrassment, and you don't want to embarrass your friend.
Totally.
And so this is, it's, I feel like almost putting out an episode about etiquette is a way to kind of put something out there where someone doesn't have to worry about embarrassing someone and someone doesn't have to worry about actually making a host uncomfortable, potentially.
Yeah.
I'm basically doing, you know, I'm doing the Lord's work. Service.
Well, I have to say, though, we still should thank the people who are commenting about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's interesting that this discussion's happening, you know.
It's great.
So in some ways, whether people agree with your take or not, you've achieved your goal of starting a discussion around.
Actually, you're 100% correct.
Right.
Because I think having that discussion about etiquette, like, inherently makes people more aware of how they behave at a table.
Right.
Someone did write a comment that was really interesting. They said, you know, what I was always told is that, like, don't put out the china unless you're ready to accept. Don't put out the fine china unless you're ready to accept that there could be damage. To which I say, I 100% agree. But if you're in a fine china club and someone who comes to the fine china club is constantly, like, throwing a plate on the floor, then, you know, either they're kicked out of the fine china club, but maybe you really like them and you just want them to know, don't do that with the plate.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, it's a discussion that will rage on. And for those who feel like I have aggressed their experience, I apologize. It's not supposed to be that deep.
I don't know. I don't think anyone takes it that
I'm knocking that over stuff. As I speak about knocking over plates, I'm actually actively knocking over my headphones over here. But anyway, yeah, I agree. It's cool to see people's responses. And it's also reassuring to know there was, like, I would say the vast majority of people really felt actually heard.
Yeah.
Were like, yes, I totally agree. I feel this way too.
You know? Right.
So anyway, enough about finger etiquette because we talked about that last time. What games have you been playing, Jordan? What's a game that you played that you want to talk about?
Well, we've been playing a good number of games together, but why don't we start off with a non-space game?
Non-space.
Inventions.
Inventions.
Yeah.
If potentially could have been a space game if the timeline of the game lasted long enough.
Interesting. Well, it ends with AI and computers, so I guess
theoretically space actually kind of happens in there.
Maybe.
So Inventions, new Vital Lacerda.
New Lacerda game.
Yeah.
We've played together.
I played once.
Once. That was your only game, right?
Yeah. So anything I say is just an initial impression. So.
And then just for the record, I've played 5 games now.
So you have a pretty good not understanding of the game, but you have a lot of plays under your belt, so you can really.
I have a good number, so I can share my opinions.
Your opinion may has more data points to pull from.
Maybe so.
What do you think about it, Jordan? Where do you stand on it? How do you like it? How's it stand without the Lacerda games? Give me everything.
Everything.
Okay. Get into it.
So, first of all, just as a general statement, I do like it. I think it's an interesting game, and I think where it puts its energy, which is the action chaining system, is pretty interesting. So, in the game, you can take an action, and there are 10 different actions in the game, and I think 3 of them, or maybe 4, have an opportunity for you to chain into another action. And when you do that, you move to the top of that next action. It's just like that was the first action of your turn. You go from there. So although over the course of the game, you only have 13 turns, you could on any given turn take 3 or 4actions.
Only 13 turns. It's only 13 turns. 45 turns.
I know, right? Wild. Because, well, sometimes on your turn, you're taking 3 or 4 different actions.
Yeah.
And there are other ways to cheat chains, involving the milestones and involving some of the technology tiles you can get. So, you know, you could take as many, I think, like the max would be 5 or 6 actions in a single turn, which is if someone's not chaining, that's half a game, you know,
right,
in a single turn. So it's pretty crazy the way that works. And when you're playing it, it's a very fun puzzle to analyze of, okay, I definitely need to hit this action. Mm-hmm. I need to take the invent action at some point during my turn. But I'd like to accomplish more than that. How can I do that? Well, let me think of what I can do before that I can chain into the invention action. And let me think about what I can do after that I can chain out of the invention action. What's the most, you know, efficient combo? You know, or I really need to take both of these 2 different actions. And there seems to be, you know, too large of a distance to bridge between them. Can I find a clever way to chain from one to the other?
You know what it reminds me of? So I live in a townhome, and so it has 3 stories. And one of the nightmares of a townhome, and I know this may sound very privileged, so I apologize, but one of the nightmares is, you know, you go all the way upstairs, and you realize you left something all the way downstairs. And it's like the up going upstairs and downstairs, and upstairs and downstairs, and upstairs and downstairs. And so what happens is you're like, oh, I have to go downstairs right now. What can I bring? How can I organize my tasks so that everything I do is like third floor task, second floor task, and now here great. I am on my first floor. I made it to the first floor, so that way I don't have to go up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. You know, yeah, that's sort of what the game is like.
So funny. You know, my partner and I are looking for a house now, and what we're considering a townhouse that's also three stories.
Yeah.
And that's her number one concern. She's like, I don't want to have to go up and down the stairs. And
it's,
I was like,
it's a thing.
Yeah, it's really funny.
I have to say it's a thing. Well, I used to, I mean, like, I was apartment life. I was always in apartments.
Yeah.
And anytime I'd go to someone's apartment that had like a staircase in it, just like a two-story apartment, I'd be like, wow, a second story. That's so cool. And I was like, getting this townhome, I was like, ooh, now we have two staircases. Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, sure.
ranch houses all the way.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, yeah, I really like that central puzzle of optimizing, you know, as you move downstairs, what you need to do. But I think there are a few areas where the game is, you know, falls down in comparison to some other Lacerda games.
Okay.
And the primary one that I know you're going to talk about, Ben, is the thematic integration of... in like upgrading your society's technology,
yes.
Which by the way is the central focus of this entire game.
Yes.
Is there's this, you know, three or four action chain that results in one society inventing and sharing with the world a new technology. And then when you get that technology, it doesn't inherently do much. It gives you one more chain option sometimes.
Sometimes.
And that's all it does. And, you know, it gives you a discount on certain tiles. And it scores you points at the end of the game. But it doesn't feel like when you just get a new technology in TI and now you can do something really great and special.
Exactly. So my first impression of the game is I enjoyed it. When I was playing it, I enjoyed it. It clicked more and was more fun for me than Weather Machine. But again, I only played Weather Machine once. Mm-hmm. So, you know, take that with a big grain of salt. I actually just kind of wrote about this a little bit on my BGG blog that I kind of quietly do on the side, about first impressions of some of these games. And so the things that I really liked at first blush with Inventions was I liked the action selection, which Paul talked about on the latest, on a previous episode, where like when you take an action, every time you take an action, you're going to block off another action for yourself. Like there's always right. like two spots that are adjacent, and whichever spot you choose, the other spot is now blocked off, which is a really fun puzzle. I really enjoy that. And then there's also an element of if you choose an action that someone else is at, then they may get, they'll get some influence, which I always enjoy that kind of interaction, you know? So I really enjoyed the action selection in the game. Mm-hmm. The act of bringing inventions, having your society like make an invention is like this multi-tiered piggybacking system that was reminiscent to me of building a power plant in CO2, where in CO2 you have to like, there's the infrastructure and then there's something else. And like people just do like once one person makes the infrastructure, it opens up the window for someone else to build on top of that or something like that. I'm a little rusty on my CO2 thing. So I like that. Mm-hmm. But I also felt like the thematic integration was not strong in a way that kind of annoyed me. Like if a game has really good mechanics, if the mechanics are just like Barrage, I don't really care too much about the theme. Like Barrage's theme is so ridiculous. I guess I like the theme of water coming through because that's integrated, but like
the Barrage, that's sort of the primary theme of Barrage though. I mean, yeah it has these like sort of weird sci-fi trappings settings around
maybe,
it.
Maybe the setting is silly.
Right. The setting is silly, but I think the theme works.
Okay. So but in this case, I agree with you. You do all this work to create an invention, the right. namesake of the game. And then you get your invention and you put it by your player board. It gives you a discount on putting it down hexes. And like the hexes are basically an abstract little game you're playing with yourself.
They can be somewhat thematic, which we'll talk about in a moment. Right, but they are exactly. an abstract little like game you're playing by yourself. Yeah.
But like it is ultimately like this little. So you get a discount and you do get another chain option. And that's a chain option that you only get if you take one specific action. Right.
Right. Right.
So it's a limit. So it offers limited utility. Right. Nice utility, but limited.
Right.
And I felt like, gosh, this whole game is about inventions. And once you make one, It just sits there. It's just a card next to your board.
Right.
And that actually did bother me.
I think that's fair. And I think you can feel it as well in terms of the milestones, which are the tiles on the left side of the board.
Yeah.
That give you, in order to invent technology, you need to know most of the time a particular milestone.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish I had an example to mind, but you know, to invent one of the milestones is computers. Mm-hmm. And so maybe to invent, you know, something that would require computers, I'm not sure what it would be, a server or whatever, you would need to have access to this computer milestone. And what access to this computer milestone boils down to is it on the board in like your little zone and do you have a guy on it? And or is it in this public knowledge display? But what access to that information does for you, all it does is let you invent the thing that requires it.
Right.
And there's no difference between having knowledge of or access to, you know, whatever, AI or computers or whatever, all the way down to having access to, you know, stone yeah. and bone weapons or whatever.
Right. It's
like, they don't feel different at
all. Like domestication of dogs is no different than having access to AI in the game.
Right, exactly.
And it's like, it's a cool concept. It reminds me of Anno 1800, where you, right, like you sort of work your way up this tech tree where you understand this technology, which then unlocks another technology. Right, isn't that with Anno? Like you have that entire grid. And like you build on the knowledge that you already have or you use other people's knowledge. And that's what's so cool about Anno. And I think with this game, it's like there's constantly knowledge that you have and then you have these inventions, but it never feels like the game synthesizes these parts into something greater of like, ooh, I know this thing and I have this invention and now I can use them in tandem to do something else. And maybe this is me as a first time, I fully will accept all the Reddit comments that say you don't know what you're talking about.
Sure, sure.
You know, because I've only played it once, but it didn't feel like there was a sense of growth in my society,
mm-hmm.
and I felt like you know, we have this map also, and I'm just moving meeples around the map, and it didn't feel like anything more than that. It felt like I was pushing things around to just to engage with mechanics. And so, I still enjoyed my play. Let me like not hide that part. I enjoyed it, but I felt like I had thematic failings.
Right. And so like for instance, I think the real thematic growth in your society is meant to be represented by these hexes you can get.
Right.
And they can score you points. There are certain ones you can get by sharing inventions with the world. So there's competition over getting those tiles, and that's where many of your points come from. But there are also three different colors of tiles. I think they're technology, financial, and culture tiles. And they have, you know, somewhat thematic names, and they let you do different sorts of things. And so there is some growth there, but it's not tied to the technology you invent. Anytime you have access to a new culture tile, you can pick any culture tile you want.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also no lasting impact on the board. Like, for instance, the roads technology lets you move two people when you would normally move one person, I mm-hmm. think.
Yeah.
But there's no roads on the map, right? The world right. isn't growing. It's just, oh, you have roads, so your people, more of them can move, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Or maybe they move one step further. I don't remember. Anyways.
Those hexes were all thematically named, and their abilities matched what they were called. But to me, you know, there's always a discussion of theme versus setting. To me, that just, again, felt more like setting. It felt more like, oh, like we can call these hexes something that matches the setting.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't make me feel like I was doing the thing.
Right.
And again, sometimes it's like, well, how much does that matter though? Right. You know, cause if the mechanics are good, then it doesn't really matter. But I think my counter to that is like, if the mechanics are good, but not like amazing, I'm going to start leaning on the theme a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And if the theme isn't there, then I'm going to be like, oh, okay. Like, cause there's some games where I'm going to lean, the theme is so great that the mechanics, I'm sort of like, yeah, that's, I'm okay with it. Like for me, Hegemony, the theme is so strong for me that like, I don't need my mechanics to be like super A level, but there's some games where the mechanics are just so sharp and so great that like the theme being flimsy is okay with me. But I think maybe a sort of a middle section here, and especially, I don't know, is it unfair? Is this like me? Is it me judging Lacerda based on like his previous games where it's been integrated so well?
That's what I was about to say. I think it really is. We're judging it by a high standard because the theme is really great in every other Lacerda game except maybe Weather Machine.
Right.
And so it's difficult because I think the mechanics in Inventions actually are great. I think they're really interesting and they do a lot of new things with the action chaining.
The chaining is really cool. Right. I also really like the chaining.
Yeah, it's great. And also, you know, I think the tile placement puzzle is really fun and interesting. But because we have these other great Lacerda games like On Mars and Lisboa, where the theme and, you know, Kanban, really all of them,
Kanban's
where the theme so just much. Feels so integrated with the gameplay and where it, you know, it really evokes those feelings to a way that it even helps you remember the rules of the game.
It does, yeah.
In Lisboa and in, yeah, in all these games.
His games really need that. And like, so, but one thing I also don't know is like, hey, his games always require for me, like, you need to sort of like, you need to wrap your mind around it. And so sometimes like, I'm just focusing on like, okay, how am I making this stuff all work together? Is it unfair for me to ding the game's theme and integration if I'm like not quite even seeing the forest for the trees yet? Like maybe like once I internalize the rules and I can play, like when we talked a few episodes ago about Great Western Trail Argentina and how like my first several plays were like fine, but it was like the most recent play where the rules were truly like internalized. I was like, oh yeah, like this game is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, am I unfairly judging a game when I myself have not fully absorbed what I need to be doing and how I should be digesting this game?
I think maybe it is unfair after only one play for a Lacerda game that's like so heavy to say that you feel the mechanics are hard to grok. Because I find after one and a half plays, probably I got to the point where the rules really flowed very well.
It's not
well
so much that
it's very simple.
It's not to say that the mechanics are hard to grok. Maybe it's unfair to say the mechanics are not exciting.
Sure.
Because hard to grok is hard to grok.
Yeah, that's fair. And I will say the you know, the actions on the board have every step of that you take with that action printed next to them.
Yeah.
And those reminders are super useful and helpful. So I really like that bit of visual design.
I have a little quibble, and I don't know how you get around this because this happens with other games too. Is that sometimes when games try like actually so hard to be thematic, which is kind of a paradoxical critique of me saying, oh, it's not thematically integrated. And now I'm going to say this game, in an effort to be really thematically integrated, will often call actions certain things, like this is a Eureka action or something like that. And when you look at a player aid or you look at something that says, when you take a Eureka action, you're like, wait, what the hell is a Eureka action? You know, like things like that.
Eureka is the one that's the hardest to remember because you only do it a few times in the game.
Yeah, there's just there were a few moments in the game where it was like referring you to actions, and the action names were more thematic than they were functional. Mm. And I remember that was like just a minor quibble that was like very annoying to me.
That's fair. I have one more comment about the game.
Yeah,
there's. And I feel like I've been overly negative because I really do enjoy this game. I've played it 5 times. I want to play more of it. So I want to put that out
there. But we always leave a negative on a podcast. That's the thing.
Yeah. It's not fair because it is a you know, the chain system is brilliant. It's really cool. I'm concerned after 5 plays about the longevity of the game versus other Lacerda games.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because in most games, you're going to do mostly the same stuff. You're going to try and get the wealth tiles, which score you most of the points. Maybe one game you'll go for, you know, brown and white tiles, and one game you'll go for white and green tiles or whatever, but you're pretty much going to go after the same sort of thing. You're going to mostly have the same abilities in every game. You know, all of the ability tiles, there's always one fewer than the number of players. Mm. So maybe someone beats you to a tile, or everyone beats you to a tile that you wanted, and you won't get that one for one game, but it doesn't feel that different. Whereas if you're playing on Mars and you have certain buildings, they can dramatically change your play style. Or maybe you want to focus on, you know, building a massive water complex, or, you know, depending on which end game scoring cards are in play, that'll change your play a lot.
Yeah.
And it feels like in Inventions, that's not really
I could see that.
Much.
Yeah. I mean, again, I did enjoy it. I really did. I'm not just saying that to, you know, fend off people who were like, what the hell? But I did enjoy it. And I actually, even though I was, it took me a moment to grok it, I actually feel like I did quite well with it. Like I was doing, unless maybe I cheated at some point, but I don't think I cheated. I filled up almost my entire little hex map and everything. Yeah. I had like a really, I think I lost to you by 1 point.
You lost me by 1 point.
Which was kind of amazing.
And it was my fifth play or something. So it was a very good first play.
Yeah. And I think there was one small thing I could have changed that would have, you know, who knows.
Totally.
But, so I definitely enjoyed it and I was able to like see what to do.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like I was like lost at sea. I was like, well, I hate this game. I just felt like, when it was over, I didn't think about it very much afterwards, and I didn't feel overly pressed. Like, I didn't want to, like, dive back in the way that, like, on Mars, it's like, oh, my God, this game was awesome.
Yeah.
Lisboa had, you know, I remember, like, the first time I played it, like, you're just in that, like, space of, like, everything's so cloudy and murky, and you're like, what am I, how does this all work? And then, like, there's a moment where the sun, like, just comes through the clouds, and you're like, oh, I get it. I see it all. And it's just like so exciting. Yeah. And I felt that with Kanban and others, but yeah, it didn't quite like hook me. And I like what I debate with is like, how many plays do I owe a game? Mm. You know, like, cause we know what hooks us and we know what doesn't hook us. But then again, Great Western Trail, Argentina, like I kind of was like, yeah, it's fine. And then all of a sudden we have this amazing play and it's like, you know, you don't want to like miss out on these, like a game that could be amazing for you. And then because you're just like, well, but it was good, but not great. I'd rather play another game, you know?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I think I'll play it at least, I'll probably play it 5 more times. And I think it'll probably stay in my collection, but yeah. It's probably not going to be my favorite Lacerda. And, you know, and it's not going to have, I've played on Mars many more than 10 times, I think.
Wow.
I just think it's such a great,
it's
great
so
game.
It's so good. It's
and
so
I don't
good.
Know if this will have that same longevity. Now, does that mean that it's not a game worth exploring? Absolutely not. I mean, 10 plays, it's a Lacerda. It's a great game.
You know what? I'm just going to wait for you to foist it on me because Jordan and I have decided that when we play games, we're going to have a rotating dictatorship. And one time I will choose and another time he will choose. And so, and that's just the way it's going to be. And it'll be great. This way we both have our voices will be heard.
Yeah. And you know what? I think Inventions, not to speak for Elder who isn't here, but I think he really likes it.
He does really
like
it.
And so if he gets a choice at a game night, I think he might be interested in picking.
He chose it the number one game he would be most excited to get to the table this weekend.
There you go.
So and he was the only one. It was interesting because when Inventions first arrived, everyone but Elder put it on as their choice for like top 5 games that'd be most interested to play that weekend. It was the first time we ever had that many overlaps in game brain of excitement. And now no one has put it on their list of being excited for it except for Elder.
Well, we've talked about this before. Elder has a different style where he plays games 50, 20, you know,
a million times. Yeah.
And we play them, you know, once sometimes or 5 times.
You know what? Speaking of Elder,
sure.
What a natural transition.
Okay.
I played a game with Elder.
What was it?
I played Galactic Cruise with him.
Oh, that's right.
On TTS. And it's a really interesting, this is going to be an interesting complement to Inventions because, well, you'll see, I think. So Galactic Cruise, it's not even out yet, but
it is a space game, though.
It is a space game. It's our first space game in our topic. Our topic that will intermittently come through the episode.
Right.
So it just finished a really successful Kickstarter. There's a TTS mod, Tabletop Simulator, on Steam. And so, I'd heard about Galactic Cruise for a while. It had been at the top, like the hotness
for sure. Yeah.
And, I finally did some research on it, watched like a rules video. And I was like, this looks so cool.
It kind of looks like a Lacerda in some ways.
It looks very
Lacerda. Is it E&O Tool art?
E&O Tool art.
Yeah. Okay.
And there's like lots of procedural things.
Sure.
The gist of it is that all the players work for a company that sets up galactic cruises, like spaceships that take people to planets, and they go. It's just like space tourism, and whoever does it the best becomes the president of the company. And so the whole game is about building these cruises. So it's actually in many ways like Shipyard, which I'm going to talk about briefly at some later after this at some point or throughout it. Who knows? the world's our oyster.
Sure, sure.
But you've got to get your spaceship, and then you need to build experiences in your spaceship, like rooms, you know, like you might want a bar or a restaurant or like a zoo or something. You could put all this stuff in your spaceship. So you have to get blueprints, and then you got to turn blueprints into actual physical spaces on your ship. And then you've got to advertise for your crew so you can get people to pre-buy their tickets, and you've got to choose an itinerary. So it's like, you're sort of like building up the whole thing. And then once you have your thing ready to go, you can launch into space. Mm-hmm. And one of the most delightful design elements of this game is that when it's time to launch, there's like a checklist of five things you have to do to like do it. Mm-hmm. This is procedure. And they arrange it in a way, they have like a little tower, you know, like an actual, like a NASA, if you have a spaceship, like a rocket or a spaceship. That's like, there's like the tower that it's like next to. So the tower they have, it's like they put the five steps in the tower, and the step number five is at the bottom, and like it goes 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, liftoff, which is, I mean, that to me is like, I love when people think about that shit in design.
Sure.
It's just so fun.
Yeah.
And then the spaceships go on their galactic cruise, and they stop at planets. And when they stop at planets, you can get upgrades to your ship. And it's like,
so how much of your time is spent building new ships, and how much of it is spent managing ships that you've already launched?
So in my one play, it was like the first half is the building.
Oh, and then you're done building?
No, you continue to build, but like you sort of create this infrastructure that then all of a sudden the ships start going off.
Okay.
And every time a spaceship is launched, you put like a little cube on this like progress track, and that's the timer of the game. Because once the progress track fills up, there's like intermittent scoring, and then there's a final scoring. So it's basically a race game. And so one of the tensions in the game is, do I do some small sort of crappy spaceships, but I can send it off into space, and I can get my upgrades that are up there in space. But I won't get as many points for them, or to do a really big ship that's gonna give me a lot of points. But there's like a race. So once people start sending other ships up in space, then the game starts to really accelerate.
Yeah.
So you really feel the race of it. I really enjoyed it. But it's funny cause it looks like it's a Lacerda, and there's like the teach is kind of a big teach, but it's actually, it's very midweight.
I've heard that. Yeah.
And, the big thing is that like when you take an action, you put a meeple into like an office, and there's six offices I think there's six offices. And so you can never be blocked, but if someone's there, you bump them and they come back to someone's player board. And when they come back to player board, that person gets a bonus.
Sure.
So the interaction is, I believe the interaction is supposed to be wherever you want to get those bonuses. You want to take the action you think someone else wants, that way you can get the perks, because the perks really matter.
Right.
You know? So I really enjoyed it. A few days later, I played Shipyard Second Edition. Mm-hmm. I love Shipyard. Did you ever play Shipyard?
I've played Shipyard First Edition one time. It was good. It was a fun game.
They're like the same game. There's just some small aesthetic changes and like maybe one or two minor rules.
You mean Shipyard 1E and 2E?
Yeah. So I know Tom wants to do a deep dive of it, so I'm not going to go too into it. But Shipyard is like a great game in my mind, because it's so tense. And you're just like scraping for everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like a game of like rondelle within rondelle within rondelle. It's like a million rondelles everywhere.
Right.
And it's like so much of Shipyard is, oh, I really need to get a sail on my boat. But like, oh no, Tom just did the thing that moved the rondelle. I just went past the sail. And oh, I don't have access to the sail. Like I can either like raise money to like manipulate the rondelle, or I do a different action. But oh no, they just moved that thing. And it's just like crushing, you know?
Sure.
And I did feel like with Galactic Cruise, you could sort of do everything and get everything that you wanted relatively easily.
Interesting.
And I think the tension comes from the race.
Right.
But so I'm going to keep an eye on that. I'm happy I backed it, but I think I want the game to be a little tighter.
Yeah.
But in terms of how it relates to Inventions, one thing I thought was really where I think it excels in an area where I think Inventions fell flat was in Inventions. When you get your Inventions, they sit next to your player board, they just sit there. Whereas in this game, when you build your spaceships, they continue to have a life and they continue to do things for you and they continue to be a part of the game and you interact with the thing that you spend so much time building and mm-hmm. there's so much fun and joy in playing with that thing.
Yeah.
And that is a good example to me of like thematic integration.
Yeah, it's interesting. So how many ships do you build in a game of Galactic Cruise?
I built three.
Okay.
And I had a fourth one that never quite got off the ground and cost me some points.
So it's kind of similar. I guess like in inventions, normally you personally would invent probably four or five inventions. You'd participate in the invention of like 16 because, you know, they're all, you know, gross mm-hmm. projects. That's interesting. Here's another strange question about Galactic Cruise.
Yes.
Is there anything inherent about it that necessitates the space theme or could it just be cruise?
I was thinking about that the other day. I mean, it could have been, I'm trying to remember what it was. It could have been probably just a cruise.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember. There was something I did come up on with something where I was like, oh yeah, that's gotta be space. I think they probably just did it for fun.
For fun. Yeah, sure.
And it is kind of
that's
fun.
That's fine. Yeah, totally.
The art is really delightful. It has like a depiction of space that feels like cartoony and fun. It kind of reminds me of the Jetsons. It's not the Jetsons, but it's sort of, it's vibrant colors. It's fun. You go to planets. There's like a lot of storytelling. Here's one. I think Galactic Cruise is a game that I thought was going to be tighter and more agonizing than it was, but the theme was so fun and so delightful that it's a real joy to play.
The mechanics.
Yeah. Sure. I don't know. I wonder with our group if it's going to really take off. I worry that it's going to be, it might not be tight enough for everyone.
Based on your description, I'm glad I didn't back it, but I'd happily play it one time.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of stuff going on. Yeah. Like there's a lot of considerations, a lot of choices. I felt like I was able to do everything, but also we only played a 2-player game, which involves like a little dummy meeples and stuff like that.
Sure.
So I did enjoy it quite a bit. I think I want it to be a little tighter,
sure,
but I'm going to keep an eye on it and I want to play it again.
Are there rules changes coming? I mean, is it final or?
I have no idea. I do know that there's like two expansions that are part of the Kickstarter and I backed the expansions too. I don't know if they tighten anything up. Yeah. But also like if the player board's more crowded, you know, that could be a thing. It's one of those games where there's it's like you're racing for lots of different things, itineraries, special power cards, mm-hmm. locations. So it's like a bunch of races.
Yeah.
But it's different than the tension you get from, you know, something like Shipyard.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else have you been playing?
Well, I'm wondering, I know we want to talk about TI and ARCs.
Yes.
Do we have time to do something before that or should we just jump into those?
If you want to do something before then, go into it.
Okay. I've been playing a solo game called Resist.
Oh.
Designed by David Thompson and one of his many co-designers whose names I'm forgetting at the moment, for which I apologize. But it is a very fun solo game that takes like 20 minutes to play.
Wow.
Wherein you play as the Spanish Maquis, which is like a guerrilla force fighting against Franco. And it's just such a delightful game. The way it works is so wonderful. So
I think of like playing as a guerrilla force, I'm like, what a delight.
Well, okay. I mean, it does have a serious theme and, you know, you have to consider that. But the decisions are just so tasty because every round you'll have an option of choosing from one of four missions, which are laid out that all have negative effects. And they're things that you want to accomplish as your guerrilla force. And they all have some, guards, some like enemies that are, you know, working for Franco associated with that mission, which randomly get pulled off the deck. And you might know what some of those guards are, some of those enemies are, and some of them you won't know until you declare that you're going into that mission. And then you have this hand of five Maquis, and these are like big tarot sized cards that are divided in half. And on one half, there's the concealed side, the hidden side of the monkey. And it has some piece of art and it's someone, you know, doing something covertly. Okay. And then you'll have one that's the revealed side and it's someone going ham, like accomplishing some big thing. So for instance, there's one monkey and on the, you know, hidden side, he's typing at a computer and, you know, he's got some papers next to him. And on the revealed side, it's him with like a chain gun and his hair is like going crazy and his glasses are like falling off. So the art's great. Anyway, every turn you have to decide whether to play one of these monkeys on for their hidden action, in which case they'll live from this event, whatever happens, you know, most of the time, and they'll get shuffled back into your deck, or to put them on the revealed side, which is a powerful action, but then they're going to get killed by virtue of, you know, revealing themselves.
They're always going to get killed.
If you play with the revealed side, they're basically always going to get killed or taken prisoner or whatever the case may be. So it's really fun to manage this group. And you have 12 Maquis that you'll start the game with. And you're trying to accomplish as many missions as you can, you know, with escalating stakes and escalating negative effects and more enemies and bigger, you know, combat scores required. And your deck is dwindling all of the time because you've had to play some revealed Maquis. And you can recruit some more into your deck from this, you know, recruit pile. But that's a hard effect to find. There aren't that many of them. And so, I don't know. It's just such a fun game of these like escalating tensions. You really have to manage your deck and manage each individual combat, and combined with the delightful art and like the wonderful theme, I think it's just a really great game. It takes like 20 minutes to play. And then once you've played a few times, this might be my favorite part. They recommend that you take all the Maquis. There's 24 in the game and you start with 12 and you just draw two and pick one that you want to recruit and one that's going to go out and you know, be in the recruit pile. So one you'll actually have for the mission. So you got to draft your little team of Maquis and you'll draft your 12 Maquis. Anyway.
Sounds like it'll make a good app.
It could be a good app. I can imagine that. There's also, so anyways, it's a delight. Most solo I would highly games recommend would it if you like, and I don't even like solo games. Yeah, that's true. I guess most solo games.
How did you find out about it?
You know what? I think it was mentioned both on So Very Wrong About Games, another podcast, and I think Candace's podcast. I think Candace mentioned it. And there is also another version of it that instead of using these guerrilla fighters as a theme, use witches as a theme.
That's kind of funny because it sort of vaguely reminded me of Broom Service. And the idea that like with Broom Service, you play a card for like the cowardly effect or the brave effect. But it's different, obviously, because it's not like you lose your witch after you play it for the brave effect. But there's this idea that like, it's a high stakes play to go go bigger, but yet it could get bigger rewards.
There you go. So the witchcraft game does have, it's called Witchcraft, does have that exact thing, except you do, I think, lose the witch.
Okay.
Although I'm not sure. I haven't played that version of it. But anyway, it's a delightful game. And even if you don't like solo games, you can get it out and play it in like 20 minutes. It's just a delight. I'd highly recommend exploring it. It's a nice small little box.
And David Thompson has published a lot of stuff. Actually, Resist is from 2022.
Yeah, it's relatively new, and I think Witchcraft is even newer. And the co-designer on Resist
Did War Chest.
Trevor Benjamin and Roger Tankersley, as well as David Thompson.
War Chest people love. I've never played it.
I've heard it's great.
But I heard that's a really good two-player game.
Or four, I think.
Or four. Mm-hmm. That's very cool. And by the way, you're also really excited for PAX Penning to come in. But did it arrive yet?
No. I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Yeah. You were telling me about that over bagels a few days ago.
We'll cover that when it comes in. Okay. But I have that and Turncoats, the other game from Milda Matilda Games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we played, do you want to start with Arcs or you want to start with Twilight Imperium? How do you want to do it? Because now we're going big space.
Now we're going big space. For the rest of the pod.
So we played Twilight Imperium last weekend.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with there.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
And it was a five-player game.
Right.
And I had never played five-player TI4, and I actually loved it at five players.
It was great.
I thought it was really tense. Now, part of that, one thing that was really funny is the players were the two of us, friend of the podcast, James, friend of the podcast, Jake, and person on the podcast, Paul. And Jake's wife, Cassie, she came over to sort of like see us off on our journey of Twilight Imperium. And we were like, Cassie, well, we tried to get her to play. And she's like, no, I'm not there yet. Right. She's like, I don't know if I'm ready to go back to Twilight Imperium. But we gave her the task of assigning our factions.
Right.
What we did was we gave her we did a random poll. We each got like what, one expansion and two base game ones.
Right. And then we each eliminated one of those three options and gave the other two to Cassie to pick from for us.
Yes. So Cassie curated our factions, which was hilarious because she really did a number on us.
She did. She picked very aggressive factions. Yes. Everyone was very aggressive.
Yes. You had the supreme joy of being the virus.
It was wonderful. It was very fun. I was the virus.
Which people like the virus I've never played the virus, but that's a tough one.
It was fun. It was a fun one to play. And then you played one of the expansion ones, right?
Yes, I played the Tyrants of like Ul or something like that.
Mm.
And then Paul was also, you were sitting between me and Paul.
That's right.
And Paul was the cabal of, I forgot their names, but the lizards.
The cabal.
Lizard dinosaur types.
Ones, yeah.
And then Jake was based like space pirates, and James was, his special power was having
a big
fleet.
Barony
of Letnev.
Right.
So he had a big fleet. So it was a really interesting game. And the two of us, we had a journey together.
We were at loggerheads for much of the game. Yeah, it was a very interesting game. But we've been saying since this game happened that it was one of the most exciting games of TI we've played because there were so many big moments.
Tons of big moments.
Right.
And I found that the five-player experience just felt really intense. It was like, it was tighter. I think maybe because the board was tighter.
It was a very tight game because at the end of the game, in the scoring phase, there were three of us that were going to have 9 points. And in turn order, it was me and then James and then Paul. And James and I each had a chance to draw off the secret objective deck and try and score. And if we would, if we draw one that we could just immediately score, we'd win. And then if not, it was going to be Paul. Right. So I drew one and I couldn't score it. James drew his and he could score it. So he won the game.
He won.
And if he had missed, Paul would have won. So that's how tight it was.
It was incredibly tight. So for me, the most significant moment for me, from my experience in it, was there was a moment maybe like a third of the way through the game where we were sort of working together. We had kind of like a detente-ish thing because as the virus, you can't get technologies unless you
get attacked.
Unless you get attacked or just
no, you, sorry, no, unless you kill something. I kill at least one unit in a combat, then I get to copy one of the techs that my opponent in the
combat. So you came and took over one of my small plans. You killed like a little fighter, like a little infantry member. And then the plan was the next round you were going to move off.
Right.
And
well, we agreed to this exchange.
Yes,
I would come in, destroy one infantry, copy one of your techs. Then you'd come in and I would hope to destroy one of your pieces as I moved out and retreated to get one more of your techs.
Right.
And then leave. So you'd have the system back.
Right. And I didn't love that second part, but I think we sort of were like, we're just going to figure it out. And then the other thing that was happening was that James, who was to my left, he had built up a whole fleet and he was aiming to go onto Mechatol Rex, which for people who don't know the game, Mechatol Rex is the center of this entire board. And once you control Mechatol Rex, you get a point if you're the first one to do it. And on top of that, there is a, you have a good chance of earning more points.
Right. So
but
James,
you were also
right. James and I each had a big fleet right next to Mechatol. And during the turn order phase of the game where you select your card, which gives you your turn order, I was like, James, I'll pay you anything to let me go before you. Not anything, but I'll pay you to let me go first.
I don't think I
even
noticed this part, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
This is new to me.
Okay, so we were negotiating, and I was like, James, just let me have the Mechatol point, and I will give you my support for the throne and some resources. And I was basically saying, you'll get a point from my card. I'll get a point from Mechatol.
I don't know where I was during. Maybe I like half listened, but I was probably in my head trying to figure something out.
Maybe, maybe not. Yeah, it's hard to say. But in any event, James thought about it and ultimately rejected that deal and said, I need to go for the point myself. And I said, okay, I tried, right? I tried to negotiate with him.
Yeah. So meanwhile, something that had happened leading up to this was while I was looking, I had an interesting map position because as the virus, you knew that you needed to have someone to leech off of. So you had kind of actually developed the maps that way. I was sort of kind of like had to kind of head into you. So I was going to be like, leech E number one, right?
Well, I was hoping, you and I would get to attack each other a bunch. And I was hoping to make them small combats to get a bunch of tech.
But what happened was that, like, I kind of got penned in a little bit because you'd come in, you'd taken up a planet as per our deal.
Right.
And, but there wasn't, there was sort of like empty voids around me. So there wasn't any place for me to really expand into. So I had like four planets and I was just sitting there like, what am I going to do? I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, after this deal with you is done, I'm still trapped. And then James had said to me, like, Ben, you know, how are we going to help you out here? And I was like, I don't know. He's like, okay, we'll figure something out. And so then fast forward to how many minutes later?
Right.
10 minutes, whatever.
James takes the first turn order card and his first move of the round is to invade Mechatol.
Right. And he goes to invade Mechatol. And what did you do?
I played a card that let me roll, hit, like basically do a PDS attack from the thing next to Mechatol,
right,
to try and destroy the fleet that James was bringing in, which consisted only of a carrier and like some infantry to land on Mechatol.
Right.
So one hit would have been sufficient to destroy it, and I got to roll three dice,
yes,
and try and get one hit.
And you hit.
And I hit.
Which meant that his carrier was destroyed. Basically, it's like the big school bus full of children.
The big school bus full of infantry, and which would mean that I could then go,
right,
and take Mechatol.
So while this is happening, I'm half paying attention even to this. I'm like, I know they're doing something and right, whatever. They're it's like, whatever. I'm looking over my thing and my player board, and I notice that my faction has a special power, is that I can cancel any hit. Like once per round, I can cancel any hit, not just against me, but against anyone.
So now guess what's going to happen.
Yes. So this is, so in my mind, does like two things very quickly. It says, James is being attacked and James is just being really nice to me and he wants to help me. I need to help James back. So my mind goes there first. And then I say, ooh, I have this power. I could do something. So I go, I could have canceled that hit. And then all of a sudden I realize I've just inserted myself into an intergalactic,
you know,
political
what's funny
snafu.
About it too is, I think, was it Paul or Jake? One of them had the chance to copy this, to cancel this hit too. Oh, they could have sabotaged the card I played and they, before I rolled. And there was a big discussion about whether Paul was going to sabotage the card on James's behalf. And then Paul passes on that opportunity after like 5 minutes of discussion. Then I roll the dice and get the hit. And then you're like, I can cancel this hit. And then we proceed to talk about it for like 10 minutes, right?
Because in my excitement, that I could do something and that I could like help James. And then I was like, oh wait, no, I shouldn't be touching this because this is, they're fighting, but I have good relationships with both of them. And now by me offering up this service, I'm going to have to burn a bridge with one of these two people. So there was a lot of hemming and hawing.
Right.
And ultimately I decided to cancel your hit, Jordan,
right,
which allowed James to go onto Mechatol Rex.
Right.
And then from that point on, that like created a big diplomatic crisis between the two of us.
That's right. It was funny because like it was this really interesting moment in the game because it was like the shot had been fired off the cannon. You could see it like hurtling towards the carrier,
yeah,
in space. And while that was happening, there was a pause for a long discussion.
It was long discussion, yeah, but because it wound up involving everyone, because
yeah,
I was like, I don't know. And then I was like, let me get the heat off me. So I was like, what are Jake and Paul, what do you have to say about this? And they were like, we're not going to say anything.
We're not going to
weigh in. So finally I actually sided with you first. I said, you know what? I was like, I'm going to have to let that hit stand. And Paul was like, really? Cause if it were me, I wouldn't have let it stand. I was like, well,
yeah, Paul did end up nosing you over the other side. Oh, Paul. But it's really funny too. I mean, James and I both offered your support, which is a point.
Yeah, but
and like I offered resources too, right? There's a lot, like it was a lot on the line. So it was a really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, my thinking was I just felt like you potentially could get a lot of points.
100%. It would have been a 4-point.
But it was tricky. It was tricky because James is a really savvy player and he did at that point have a 1-point lead off of everyone. So it was just very funny. Especially in retrospect, maybe not as much in the moment, but it was funny that like everything felt life and death in that moment. Playing that in that moment, that I felt like everything was on the line. Like this was a real diplomatic crisis in our lives, in humanity.
Yeah, we should be fair. Like we're laughing about it now and it's a great story. At the time I was like,
You were so mad at me.
I was so mad.
You don't even understand how mad Jordan was.
I was really mad. I was honestly embarrassingly mad over like some cardboard and plastic.
Jordan was so mad. But I understood. I said to you at one point, I was like, I understand that you're mad. And I want you to know I hear you.
That's right.
I back what I did, but I want you to know I don't think you're crazy for being mad. You totally should be mad.
I remember the next turn we had a conversation where you said, so Jordan, are you going to move your...
Well, then you rescinded your deal.
You were like, are you going to remove your stuff out of that system that we talked about? And I was like, that's a lot for you to ask me to do that after you like intervene.
You were like, no, the deal is off the table.
I said you could attack, but I'm not going to spend one of my actions to help move these guys off.
It was,
you know,
we went down, we spiraled, but it was like, there were so many amazing moments because then James took over that planet and then Paul came in and then took over James.
Right.
Which is probably why Paul wanted, that's probably why Paul actually advocated for me to not to cancel the hit because he knew he was going to come in and take over James.
Yeah.
That's probably what it was all along.
Maybe. We'll have to ask him.
But then at the end of all that, Paul takes over. After this whole fraught discussion, James takes over the planet. Paul shoos off James, takes over the planet in a sneak attack. We go to the politics phase and the entire planet blows up and Paul loses all his fleets. And at the end of the round, there's no one on the planet, which is kind of just this amazing... some might say frustrating, but I think personally very funny
thing, which is why
I will love this game.
It's a great experience. It's a great story. And it's, I think, something we'll always remember. And honestly, there's something about really long games like this that you feel emotionally invested in that just brings them to another level.
Yeah.
Where it's not going to have that drama if ultimately nobody really cares.
Yeah.
And so like, because you care, that's what makes it exciting and fun. And
yeah. And the hours just to me, they whiz by. There was so 100%. Towards the end, I think, you know, some people were getting like, okay, let's wrap this up. I would have played another 2 hours. But it was probably good that it ended.
I mean, it was a long game.
It was a 13-hour game. It was a
13-hour game, yeah, for five players. So
yeah. So along those lines, a game that you've been excited about that you introduced to me this past week was Arx.
That's right. Arx is another space game, and it's meant to be it's not really meant to be a shorter TI, but it has some of the same thematic trappings. It's meant to accomplish that sort of story in a shorter period of time. Obviously, it plays very differently. So Arx is designed by Cole Worley and is being put out by Leader Games. I think it's going to deliver to backers in a few months. But you can play it on TTS, which is what we did. And the way it's set up is it is the ultimate version of Arx that you want to be playing eventually is a campaign game that takes place over the course of three sort of smaller games. And then in between those three games, there are interludes. And I think the way Cole's described it in the past is it's kind of like a Star Wars trilogy where you play the first film, some stuff happens, you have the opening scroll of the next film, and then you zoom back into the action for the second game, and then you do it again for the third. And so it's a very story-forward game, but it's based on a system that has less story, frankly, and that's the version we played. This most basic version of the game that strips out all the campaign elements, all of the sort of story developments, and even any sort of starting faction asymmetry, because we played, you know, the purest vanilla version of the game. So we really only got the mechanical taste in our game.
Right.
And I guess I should say there are three levels of the game. There's the campaign at the top. There's the base at the bottom. And then in the middle, there's this version of the game called Leaders and Lore, where it's still just a one game, setup, but you start with faction asymmetry and we didn't play with that either.
Right? You know, normally I'm of the mindset of like, don't give me different modes. Just tell me the mode that it's supposed to be in. But I was okay with like a vanilla tutorial mode, just because I always have like, my brain does not work with Cole Worley games.
Sure.
And so I've always really struggled to get into them. So I did appreciate that there was one where it's like, here, just connect with the mechanics first before we really get into the game.
I think it's a great decision for Arx because it's such a weird game, right?
It was weird.
The way it plays is so different from anything else. And so to throw you into a campaign game where you're going to play for 5 hours and you have to understand all the intricacies of these different actions and systems without first giving you a chance to learn those actions and systems.
Yeah.
Would be a mistake, in my opinion.
Because also the actions and systems, which we'll describe probably shortly, they're not intuitive in the way of like a TI.
Right.
Like TI 4, it's like, oh, your action that you're doing now is you're going to move.
Right.
So you move your ships.
And then you fight.
And then your next action is you're going to fight. So you're going to fight. Or maybe you've chosen the strategy card that says construct. Well, guess what you do in the construct action? You construct. So like there's like, it says you're going to do this and you do it. And you can say the same for like Forbidden Stars. Like there's an action where you're going to be building troops. There's an action where you get cards. You know, like they're like pretty conceptually simple actions. But here it's like,
well,
it's a little, you could make an argument that the actions are simple, but like the way you embark on those actions is not like clear cut like those games.
Exactly. Right. The actions themselves, I think, are still simple. It's still move.
Like or build is build.
Build is build. Right. But the way you get those actions is by playing a pseudo trick taking game.
Yeah.
Which is a strange way to get those actions. Whereas in TI, you just do them. Right.
Or right. But then it's like now this one's like, oh, you have to play a card and you have to remember maybe on it's probably harder on TTS. I think in person, if you're holding cards and you can just really just be, have those cards really in your vision, you can really see, oh, the build action is on this color card and the influence actions on this card is probably, it's way more digestible than on TTS where you have to like constantly like look down at your screen at one part. At least for me.
Right. I think that's fair. So yeah, there's four suits of cards in the game and each of them has two or three actions on them, but they overlap.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a total of like five or six different actions. And the way the general flow of the game is someone's going to lead the trick.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to play a card and they're going to take all of the actions on that card. So if they play a construction card, basically I think the actions on that are build and repair. So they can build new buildings and ships or repair damaged buildings and ships. And they'll have a certain number of actions based on the number on the card. So as the numbers get higher,
mm-hmm.
they have fewer and fewer actions on them. So the two
yeah.
will have like four actions on it, whereas the six might have one or two actions on it. And so they'll play it, and then they'll do their actions, and it'll be the next player's turn. And on the next player's turn, they can either play a higher construction card, a higher card of the same suit, in which case they get all the actions printed on that card, just like if they had led. Or they can play any card face down and just do one construction action instead of four that the leader got.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can play any card face up and take one action off that card, even if it doesn't match suit. But again, one action versus four.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to manage where you're getting your actions from. And then whoever played the highest card of the led suit, by default, they get to lead the next trick.
Which is really important.
Which is like very
being
important.
Able to lead a suit is important because you're like you want to – sometimes you need to get several actions of the type of action you want to take. You want to have separate, like, it's like, oh gosh, I really need to do like three movements or something like that. So
right.
I need to have the ability to lead with like my two or my three, let's say, of a certain color, but I can only do that if I win the next trick. So like one thing that I definitely discovered in my first play, which we didn't even actually get to finish the game because
right.
I had to get back to work. But I like it was fun to see like the emergent strategy with the card play. Like it's like, oh, I see what's going on here. This is very tricky. I really, really like the trick taking aspect of the game. That was very clever. And it was, in fact, tricky. It was really hard. And the fact that you like with the initiative, which is basically taking first place, if you don't have the highest card, you could do something else where you basically ditch a card from your hand to take over initiative, but then you have fewer actions for the round, which is also not great.
Right. So you always have options available to you if you really need it,
mm-hmm.
But you know you might not be able to. And only one person can seize initiative in each trick. So if you're playing a
yeah.
four-player game, and the second player is like, I'm seizing the initiative,
mm-hmm.
you're boned, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's such a great, like, interesting system to manage.
It was cool.
Yeah.
I did like it. I felt like it was, for me, you know, I've been on this podcast many times, like, being like, yeah, I didn't love this Cold Worldly game, or mm-hmm. someone's will be like, I didn't like it at all. But I did enjoy this one. This was definitely a top-tier Cold Worldly game for me.
Yeah.
And
I think you're going to like it even more when we get to the sort of thematic campaign style.
I think so, because I was shocked by how relatively quick the teach was. Like, it was like, build is build. and move is move. It was all simple actions. And it's like, oh, and then there's this trick taking system. And here's some stuff with the dice when you battle. I was like, okay, cool. Oh, and here's cards you can take or whatever. Like, it all seemed very, I was like, wow, I'm shocked this is a Cold Worldy game. This feels like very like straightforward. But then as soon as we started playing, I was like, wait a second. I don't know how to put these pieces together. What? Right. And I was, so it took me a while to even really start to see bigger picture things. It took me a while to start engaging in battles because I was like, I'm just trying to get the flow of the trick taking. So let me just build up some resources and go for some resource scoring. I was like, just, but it was like, with every round, it was like my scope in the game started getting bigger and bigger. And so that's why I appreciated that there was actually this like vanilla mode. But I would look forward to more theme in the game.
Yes, and I think it will certainly be there, but I agree this vanilla mode's the right place to start. And I've played the vanilla mode or the level 2 mode where you start with some faction asymmetry, but that's sort of the only difference. Mm-hmm. Collectively between those two modes, maybe 5 or 6 games, and I've yet to play the campaign game, and I barely feel ready to do it now because it feels like there's just so much there. So I think it does take a little time playing in the shallows here to get to that endpoint, but I
like that playing in the shallows.
It's going to be worth it. Yeah.
I've got my swimmies on. I really enjoyed it.
Great. I'm excited to play more.
And I didn't think about it very much when it was over. I forgot that I even played it, but I said it when we played. I said, if I have any of those feelings, I'm not holding it against the game because it was vanilla mode. It's tutorial mode. It's not fair to hold that against the game. I knew that it was not going to be a session that was going to be like, oh, like, wow, what a rich, like, you know, holistic experience. I knew it was going to be like, this is a learn the ropes game. So like, don't use this as the basis of any negative reactions. I felt like were not really worthwhile.
I think that's right. I mean, it's difficult because I don't want to put people who just want to play the vanilla mode off, because that might be the game for them and they might really like that. They might like the sort of abstract feelings based battle game. And I think when you get to the, you know, the middle tier with the, like the lore and leaders, that might be enough too, right? You have your built-in asymmetry and then you're going to go out and play this game. But for me, it's the campaign that's really drawing me to continue my interaction with this game. So we'll see.
I'll have to see where I'm at after level 2, because I'm actually like strangely not into a campaign game very much. Like, or I'm not opposed, but I'm not drawn. I'm not like, oh, I can't wait to get to the campaign.
And I feel that for sure. But when I say campaign game, what I actually mean is a one-session, 5-hour game where you play 3 games in a row with this
little. Okay, that's a really good clarification.
Yeah, because, I mean, you can pack it up in between, but it's not a campaign game that might be an indeterminate length. It's 3 sessions.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of it taking the place of TI on a Saturday, sitting down and playing this game. And yeah, there are these breakpoints where there's falling action and things get resolved and story beats move forward. But that's not really like an end point. It's not really.
I think I can see that being really good once, again, once I have a grasp of the game, because I think part of understanding the mechanics is that then you can understand, you can get a sense of like, what does it all mean? And what is it all heading towards? Like, because if I'm just moving a ship around the sort of circular board or just like acquiring resources and I'm just trying to get 5 points here, 3 points there, I'm just like gathering points. But like, this is where theme is really important, actually, because it's like, oh, if I'm going to sit here and play 3 games of this in a row as part of like an overall story of the day, like I have to feel like this is my civilization getting resources, going to war across the universe, trying to take over your planet. There's like an intentionality of like behind all the actions that really matters, which is what I do get from TI4. I get the sense of like, this is my civilization. A, we need to get 10 points, which this game is like get to 30 points or whatever. But like there's a sense of like, I need to get to that planet, because if I can get to that planet, I have more resources. If I have more resources, I get more technology. I can grow my fleet. I can do this and that. And then I can take over and get da, 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 da. Like it all makes sense. And you see what you have to do. Whereas in this game, because it's sort of abstract and conceptually strange at first, you don't know what, you don't really get it.
Yeah.
And so I think absorbing the rules and getting it into your system then allows you to sort of see what you really have to do.
100%. And I'll just entice you a little bit more with like what I expect the theme to be in these the full campaign game. You have these like, you know, these sort of quests that you go on, but they're goals that are separate from the points. And at the end of each of the mini sessions, the first 2 mini sessions, your score is halved. So at the end of any points you score in session one are actually only a quarter of a point.
Oh.
Because they'll be halved twice before you get to the end game scoring. So maybe you want to get more points, but really your focus is on developing your personal story by pursuing these campaign goals that aren't point related.
Does the game board change? Like, is there something like, oh, at the end of the first session, there's some remnant that's like left over on the map that affects how we move forward in session two?
Yes. And well, I think your position on the map gets consolidated a little bit, but generally it stays the same. So if you hold something at the end of session one, and I'm not positive about this, so don't hold me to account if I'm incorrect. But I think if you hold a planet at the end of session one, you keep it for session two, your forces might change or what you have there might change. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that, changes between the games is there is an Imperium, mm-hmm. like an empire, that everyone can either participate in or fight against. And it will remain on the board and its strength will be sort of a consistent story across these three games.
Yeah, because it seems like there needs to be a connective fabric over the course of three games. Otherwise, you'll just feel like you're playing a game three times.
No, it won't be like that.
Yeah.
And your story will change what's happening too, right? Maybe you start off as the head of the empire and you're controlling all these imperial ships. Then in the course of game one, someone actually comes and takes that from you. Mm-hmm. So in game two, you have to pick some other goal for yourself. Maybe you want to, become a collector of relics and start a library, or maybe you want to become like a rogue pilot who's just doing one thing, on their one little ship, or, there's a bunch of different stories. So,
well, let's talk about space games, by the way. Let's talk about this larger, when we're talking about arcs here and you're sort of pitching the things that make it exciting. What are the things that we look for in a space game, and what makes something like a space game rather than a game that just takes place in space or has to do with space?
That's a great question.
Is there such a thing as a space game? Or are we just making this up? I feel like we know what it is. When we say a space game, I think we know what a space game is, right?
Yeah. I think space games, to me, they sing of big conflicts and, maybe dice rolling, but, sort of conquering, galactic conquering. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And technology. I think those are the two big parts of space games for me are moving troops on a map and gaining new technologies. But there are games that don't take place in space that have those, and there are games
TI4 or Forbidden Stars or Eclipse took place over a fictional countryside, but had all the same things, swapped spaceships for maybe horses and tanks or catapults or whatever. Does the game feel the same?
I think we'd feel a lot worse playing it because we'd be like colonialists just conquering lands.
But we're just medieval people in Europe who are just we're in a fictional land where different peoples trying to take over this land that has no one living in it. So there's no one being colonized. It's just resources of the different terrain. Mm-hmm. It has a different vibe. It feels different, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it would feel different. I mean, I think also the space games allow you to have really wild events and wild technologies and things that would strain believability if they took place on a normal map. Like wormholes, for instance, you can find in space games, not so much in land games.
But or even if you made it into a fantasy, high fantasy.
Yeah.
You can do it.
I don't know. What's your answer? Do you think it would feel the same or do you think it would feel different?
It would feel different to me. Because I think with space games, we do bring our association of pop culture into it.
Mm.
I think at least I do.
Yeah.
And I'm not even a big sci-fi person, but when you bring space, it just brings space sort of adds, I don't know. There's it feels like blockbuster movie, right? It's the Star Wars effect to some, the Star Trek effect.
Sure.
To some, the, I don't know, Fifth Element effect, wherever we can go down the line.
Right.
But there's something sort of exciting and unknown. And you could make that argument about fantasy too, but fantasy just has a different vibe of unknown. Fantasy doesn't always feel blockbuster to me.
Interesting. Well, I think it's certainly the case that space games feel epic.
Right.
But maybe it's just because they're long and big games, generally speaking, right? And fantasy games, you could play distilled down sort of version.
But when we talk about Galactic Cruise, they set it in space, and why does it feel more fun that it's in space rather than a cruise around the oceans? Although actually, honestly, a cruise around the oceans would be very fun too.
Yeah, I'm not sure that one would have it for me, even though it's set in space. For instance, Space Station Phoenix. That's a game I've played a few times. Have you played that one, Ben?
Uh-huh.
It's set in space. you're cannibalizing ships to build a space station, and there are different aliens. But it feels like a midweight Euro to me.
Which is fine. Oh, I mean, it doesn't feel
spacey.
It doesn't feel spacey, but I do think the space brings something fun to that game. So it might not be a space theme, but yeah. I think like a space station that has like little aliens in it and stuff. I think that's more fun than if we were building, a castle, right? Like, oh, we have these little houses, and we decide the town wants to consolidate this into a castle, and we're all going to move in together. You know, it's fun. It's just a different fun. I think it sort of like stokes the imagination in a way.
Okay. I can see that, but I would constrain its effects to large, you know, sort of conquest games like TI or Voidfall or whatever.
Well, I think a space game, like a proper space game, or like those types of games.
Right. Like Federation's another example. It's like kind of a themeless Euro that's set in space. Mm-hmm. I don't think space really adds anything for me personally. To me, it's just a themeless
Euro. Well, I think there are a lot of people who feel like when things are just put in space, it feels like a cheap ploy to make something more exciting.
Okay, sure.
Right? A lot of times people would be like, well, why not just... Like, oh, it's another game. They just threw it in space to try to get some sales.
Right.
But then at the same time, it's like, doesn't that says something about what space can bring to a game?
That's a good point. Fair. Right? People like want to set their games there. Sure.
It also heightens the stakes in a weird way. I don't know. Like, I feel like space is a place of conflict and danger and
technology.
it's like imagine all the things we can do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the idea of these alien races, too, I think that adds something to these games like TI. Like, oh, like that's a foreign type of being to me as a human. And they would think about things differently. And that's inherently interesting.
Yeah. Like I've thought in the past about Hansa Teutonica, which I love. Like top 10 game for me.
Amazing game.
Set firmly in the Middle Ages in Europe.
Right.
I feel like there's been like kind of like a little bit of a Hansa renaissance. Like people are more aware. Like there's been like a moment where people are like, oh my God, this game's really good. Shut up and sit down, finally play it. And they're like, wait, this game is good. And people are like aware of it. People have been aware of it, but I feel like there's been like a even more of an awareness, but there was a period of time where it was like, hey, there was this really great game from like, you know, early 2010s. That people aren't paying attention to right now in this time of like terraforming Mars and all this stuff. And I remember thinking to myself, like, man, if Hansa Teutonica were set in space, like it would be a blockbuster. Like if it were the exact same game and instead of trading posts or whatever, those were like spaceships that you put down. And then the cities were planets and you have the exact same game, but it's like, now shrouded in the theme of space and the bumping is like a little space skirmish and all that stuff. I think people would lose their mind that you could literally put miniatures on it. And it's like, but why would they lose their minds? I mean, do you agree with that or no?
I don't know. I mean, I think Hansa, we should correct the record actually and say, I think Shut Up and Sit Down covered it a few years ago. But when it first came out, it was like the early 2000s or something. I'm not sure. 2005, I want to say. And if it was then and it was a space theme, people would have flocked to it because there were so many Euro games out there that are, you know, set in Europe. And so people want a different theme. But if you put it out now and you made it a space theme, do I think it would necessarily be more successful? I'm not sure.
I think it actually would.
I think and they're talking about doing this, right? So clearly some people
the designer agree. the designer was thinking about retheming it.
Right.
Maybe but he didn't, but people were like, not another space theme. Like don't make it space.
Too many space themes now.
I think the designer was actually thinking about making like a mafia game.
Oh, okay.
Which is sort of interesting.
Yeah.
But I think it's like, you know, I actually am in favor of it. Like if there were like a space retheming of Hansa, because again, I don't even need the original to be touched. But it's just what space brings to it is like it just sort of like heightens the imagination around the entire game. Like the current game is you're just putting pieces on a board, you're bumping people off. You're not really thinking like, ugh, I've finally established a trade route between like this German city and that German city. Like, my experience has become so much richer. But if it's like, here comes my spaceship and we're kind of like pew, 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 whatever, there's something kind of like more playful about that, you know?
Okay. Maybe. I think there will be a lot of people who are excited for that.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I feel like it would feel the same because the mechanics would be the same. I don't know. That's just me. But like, think about like Race for the Galaxy, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a space themed game.
Right.
Do you care that it's in space?
That one, I haven't played that one that much, but I don't personally care that one's in space.
Right. I feel like that. Right. Yeah.
That's fair.
I probably feel the same way about Hanza, I think.
But I guess the thing is more like, you know, space. I guess what I'm trying to say is that space does, I believe, bring a certain amount of like epicness, like you mentioned,
yeah,
and cinema and excitement. And I wonder then what makes a good space game? Like what do you need to make a proper space game? Like I'm a little over
that's
the map here, but like when we talk about Voidfall,
yeah,
you know, and it was like, oh, this is like a Euro's version of Twilight Imperium. And I was like, I don't feel it. I feel it's like, it's just like a Euro. Like, mm-hmm, what would move the needle to make something feel like a big old space game?
So I think one thing you care about a lot for that big space game feeling is these big moments that you really find in TI,
mm-hmm,
where it creates a story that you can tell and there's conflict and, you know, maybe there's a big dice roll. Maybe it's a big deal that's struck, whatever the case may be. There's a big moment. Mm-hmm. And Voidfall doesn't really have big moments like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a Euro optimization puzzle. I think for me, it's the faction asymmetry,
mm-hmm,
and the ability to develop technologies,
mm-hmm,
and those feelings of like this big, and also I will say a big map, just mm-hmm, having a big map in front of you adds so much ambiance to the game. And so like, for me, those things are big, but the big moments make it better. Listen, TI is more space game than Voidfall. It's more intense, like it's more epic feeling than Voidfall for sure. But I would put them both in the space game category.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Voidfall is a space game. I think that where these games fall into traps is I think that there sometimes is a tendency to say, oh, it's like TI, but like faster, or TI, but like better mechanics, or TI, but this.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me, that's always a trap because I often am like, that's just not TI.
Yeah, that's fair.
Which is rough. But I think that I think the epic quality, I actually think there's something about, I don't know, is it the time as well? Is it the fact that like TI takes so many hours, Forbidden Star can be pretty long? But we played a 90-minute Forbidden Stars recently.
We did.
Where you killed me in the second round.
Which that was
second,
much
second
faster
time that
than
happened
it should
to
have
me.
Been. Yeah, probably.
But it felt like a space game to me
did,
without it being
true.
Epic.
It had a sudden end.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe
was it
at the
skirmish
time
of it all?
Something. The skirmish, the different ships rolling different dice. You know,
is there something about seeing like three ships move into an area that you control, mm-hmm, bearing down upon you, that inherently creates a sense of drama that feels like it needs to be there for a space game?
Maybe so, or you know, just seeing a representation of these big planets, and you can just imagine these massive ships moving between them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sense of scale.
Is it like the details that we fill in that's not even there? Like we imagine what it's like people on these planets. I mean, I don't play TI and imagine like, oh, I'm on a planet. Here comes a spaceship. But on some level, are we doing that? Are we really filling in the blanks and creating narratives in our heads that sort of stoke the imagination?
Maybe. I will say sometimes when I'm playing TI, I imagine being at like the foredeck of one of these ships and seeing this conflict and the planet behind it, you know,
and then seeing your missile suddenly evaporate
as you try
to take out a carrier.
Exactly. But you know what? I want to say Sidereal Confluence, not to get us too far off, is mm-hmm, feels like an epic space game. It's long. Mm-hmm. It has aliens with different technologies, but it's all negotiation. I've never played it. Okay.
But that's interesting. So there's no battle, but
it's epic. Feels epic, and I don't know if it will really feel like TI to you, but it does have a space vibe about it.
I wouldn't ever compare it to TI, and mm-hmm, so maybe because it doesn't fall into that trap, it can be epic in its own different way.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think what are like the major space games? I would say TI, Eclipse,
mm-hmm,
Voidfall right now.
Sure.
I argue for Forbidden Stars,
yeah,
even though it doesn't have much support. Then there's a whole realm of of Star Wars games. There's, what about Star Wars Rebellion? Have you played that?
I have. That's a fun game.
How do you feel about that one?
That one feels very well thematically integrated because you're trying to either hide the base from, you know, the Empire, or the Empire trying to find the base. So that feels like a game of cat and mouse kind of, but it doesn't feel, I don't know. There's something about it that feels a little less spacey. I think maybe it's because every single space on the board is just a planet.
Mm-hmm.
They're all kind of the same except,
right,
you know, they can produce different units or something. So there's too much, you know, God, what's the word? Anyways, it's too similar. The map doesn't feel like it's got any tension or any sort of features to it, you know?
Have you played Soul Last Day of a Star?
I have. That's a fun game, too.
So is that a game that's set in space, or is that a space game?
Ooh. I think that's a space game.
I think so, too.
Because you feel the rotation, right? Like you're in orbit. That feels very thematic.
Yes. I think that's one where the game is not necessarily epic, but the stakes are epic.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have a sun that's going to swallow everyone up, and it's right there and you see it. And you have this orbiting. So there is this feeling like I'm in space. I'm engaging with space. I'm engaging with the terror and the grandeur of space.
Right. But it feels like parts of it feel almost like an abstract. Like
very much
three types of buildings, and you've got, you know, two types of ships, and it's very simple.
It's very chess-like.
Yeah.
But I think because you have a big giant sun right there, which also is like, how much of it is art?
Right. That's a good point.
You know, like it's like you, that board is just like, you know, just it pulls you in.
Yeah.
Black Angel. Space game or game set in space?
Difficult. What do you think?
I think it's a game set in space.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Because you do have like these, you put your little robots in spaceships and then you fly around in space, which feels very like space game.
That part does. And the fact that the planets are cascading as your big ship moves, as the Black
Angel moves. Actually, it might be more of a space game.
But it could just be on a lake or on a, you know, it could be just be on the ocean where you're just, you know, like.
Those are islands. You're right.
Yeah, I don't know. Those are your little rowboats. You put your little people.
I mean, you have Ravagers.
You have Ravagers, pirates.
Pirates.
Yeah. I don't know. Difficult.
I think like, I don't know. I mean, I do think that every time I move those robots around the little spaceships, it actually does feel very much like a space game in those moments. But then there's so much other stuff attached that it takes away from the epic, epic immersive quality of it.
Yeah.
Pulsar 2849, you have not played.
I've not played.
I would say that's a game set in space.
Okay. I'm examining your shelf.
Yeah,
here.
I mean, Terraforming Mars.
Oh. What do you think of that one?
A game set in space.
Interesting. You know, I will say on Mars, to circle back to inventions, feels very much like a space game. I mean, I know you're terraforming.
Right.
And so you're not really moving between the planets, but it feels epic. And there's this really great bit of thematic integration where you're moving from the shuttle orbiting the planet onto the planet 100%. With your materials and then going back up to get more of them. That part of it, maybe it's just you really need some thematic hook that brings it into space, you know?
Yeah, it's weird because when you say it, when you pitch it, you're right. It is an extremely thematic space game. There is this sense of like leaving the planet, going up into orbit, coming back down. And yet, honestly, it does not feel like a space game to me.
Oh, okay, that's fair.
I wonder if it's too grounded in reality.
And there's just one planet.
Given that it's not real at all.
Sure.
But it is like the idea is like, if theoretically all this stuff was available, this is how we as humans would do this, right?
Right. It would be near future sci-fi as opposed to like, you know.
It'd be like Gattaca versus
far future sci-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that for a space game to be a proper space game, there does have to be an epic quality. There has to be a cinematic quality, like blockbuster cinema. Not sure. Just because one could say On Mars is cinematic. But I think that I need it to feel like silly cinema.
Okay.
And I think I need it to feel like, yeah, I think the thematic aspect has to be really strong. I have to emerge feeling like I did have a memory. I think what you said at the top of this was correct. It was about creating a memory. I think that you could get that in Soul.
Yeah.
That moment of like, I'm racing to get away from the sun. Cause that's the thing with Soul is that there is like a big tension that builds up.
Right.
Like, I need to get out of here. I need to get out of here. I need to get out of here. Station Fall.
very much a space game, even though it's just on a station.
That's a space game.
It feels very much like a space game. Yeah,
it's a different type of space game. Yeah, but I think that one is 100%.
That one probably falls closer to like Sidereal, where there's a lot of negotiation and mm-hmm. stuff like that too. Oh man, what a great theme! And now I'm excited
best.
To play more space games.
Space games are the best.
I can't. You know, I'm starting my first campaign of Arcs tomorrow, I think.
Okay.
You're not quite ready for the campaign.
I'm not.
We can play some more base games. But I can't wait. I'm like ready for more space games.
All right. Well, you'll report back to us on that. And, you know, maybe there'll be some other space games this week. I don't know.
We should play Sidereal soon. I can't believe you haven't played it.
I know, but you need to have a group of, what, six people?
I think six is where you want it to be. I think you could. I've always play wanted to play four, it. But yeah, six. I have a copy. We should play.
Okay. Yeah. I would love to do that. Yeah. Is there a new version that just came out? A new updated version?
Yeah. I still have the old version.
I mean, I don't care.
Think it's the same game, but it's uglier. The new version is prettier.
The new version takes place actually in medieval Germany.
Oh, okay. Oh, my God. Wow. The Hanseatic confluence.
I mean, actually, if you think about it, it's kind of funny. You know, Hansa Teutonica is about traders in Germany. And so Sidereal Conflict is trading in space, right?
That's right. Yeah. They don't operate in the same way whatsoever, no. But they do have a similar theme. Yeah.
Well, you know, if I would love to hear what people think about space games, like what are some people's favorite space games? What makes a game like a space game for someone versus just like a game that's set in space?
Yeah.
Would love to hear, like, we obviously, I don't know if we really homed in on a great definition, but would love to hear more people. So, we have a really vibrant Discord that you can find, the Game Rain Discord. How do people find our Discord? Do
we know? I think you can Google Game Brain
Discord.
And it's probably like linked on the website somewhere.
I think it might be on the website, gamebrainpod.com.
Yeah.
So, yeah, come join the discussion or just comment on Instagram when this goes live. Would love to hear people's suggestions. And I'm sure we missed a billion space games. I'm looking at my collection right now for any last minute picks. But this is me splicing in my voice to say, of course, I forgot about Evacuation, which was only my number two game of last year. Thanks, yeah. Jordan, for joining today. And you've been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matt Robinson, Tom Donnelly, Trey Alsop, and Ben Mandelker. Special thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. More on Daedalus at GameBrainPod.com. And thanks to Adam Arpelleg for our incredible graphics. Be sure to check him out at Instagram at Kerbaloni or on his website, Kerbaloni.com. You can reach us by email at contact@GameBrainPod.com. And thanks for listening. And go play some games with friends or make some friends with games.